Ice Radio. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Henrik. It's great to have you with us. RedIceCreations.com is our website. We do 3 radio programs per week on a lot of the forbidden topics that you're not supposed to know about. You can tune in whenever it suits you. You can stream or download as we dispel the myth makers and strive towards not only giving you the other side or a different story, but what we hope ultimately will lead us to the truth so that we can find answers as to why things are the way they are. We are speaking with Mike King today, who's back with us on the show to give us the chronology of the lead up to World War II. The Bad War, not the Good War, as it's been called, but the Bad War. This is one of the most devastating events in European history and for many other countries as well. But this was primarily a slaughter of European people. The official number, which we, of course, always should question, but the official number states that over 60 million people were killed, which was over 3% of the 1939 world population. And primarily, these were Germans, Russians, American, English, Italian, Polish, French, Hungarian, Romanian, Yugoslavs, but also Chinese and, of course, Japanese. And some of these numbers don't even include the post-war prison camps, by the way. So what led up to these horrific events? Could it have been thwarted? Could it have been prevented? What happened at the time that caused all of this to occur? Well, we'll go from 1848 to post-World War II today and touch upon some of the most interesting events in history that led up to World War II and what happened afterwards. Mike King is a private investigative journalist and researcher based in the New York City area. A 1987 graduate of Rutgers University, King's subsequent 27-year career in marketing and advertising has equipped him with a unique perspective when it comes to understanding how public opinion is indeed scientifically manufactured. Interesting show here ahead, so stay tuned. Hey, Mike, welcome back. Good to hear from you again. Hope you're doing well today.
Yes, hello, Henrik. Good. Thanks for having me back again.
Well, you bet. It's always such an important topic to talk about World War II and to understand our history, and I think as well to understand why things are the way they are today. It's such an important historical event, and I thought about this the other day, but it's almost like when you think about World War II, since it's so close, I think we have a different view of it, perhaps, some people do anyway, today, as opposed to, let's say that we read about a historical war between, you know, the Roman Empire, you know, the Punic Wars, the Roman Empire and the Phoenicians, or we read about, you know, the Trojan War. So it's like they seem so far away and so mythical. But in reality, these wars are modern wars, are at least, if not even more important than those old wars, but they come with the same kind of connotation and importance and weight that those old wars. It's just that we're so damn close to it, timeline-wise. This is, I mean, we're coming up on the 75-year mark here soon. Soon enough, it'll be 100 years away, and that's not that long time, you know. And I think we need to revisit over and over and over again and understand what actually happened to be able to understand our world today, Mike.
Oh, absolutely. And I've said this again and again and again, to paraphrase Franklin Roosevelt, that it is really impossible to have a complete understanding of the world today and all that ails it without a solid understanding of World War II, because it was a turning point in history, and the direction of the turning point has been downward ever since. So that's why I spend so much emphasis on my website, tomatobubble.com, on this subject of World War II, because it is relevant. So much that grew out of it is in force today. And I go even deeper. In order to provide a thorough understanding of that event, we really have to go back at least to the 1800s. And that's what's kind of unique about my book. It's not just about a six-year event. I mean, I give you 100 years of history condensed in the 245 pages with 500 illustrations. So it's a crash course. It's simple, but it's not superficial at all.
Exactly. Very, very good. I mean, the book here is called The Bad War, The Truth Never Taught About World War II. And you've done a great job with the book, as you do. And of course, you do have a different angle. You go into, you know, old copies of the New York Times and dig out some gems and some great stuff, which is really, you know, shows us that other side and shows us that at the times when these conflicts were raging, it was not at all on the same level as we're taught today in kind of the post-World War II propaganda times that we live in now. But and we're definitely going to talk more about some of those gems, by the way, later that you've dug out as well. But let's just talk a little bit about the first section of your book, Seeds of Future World Wars. From you've laid a good timeline here from basically 1848 to 1913. Set the stage for us a little bit about what this what actually happened at the time. And I want to say another thing to add to that, too. And something that people usually do, which is a big mistake, is that they don't look at history in a continuous line. They start at just one specific point. And you know, if you do that, you can see that anybody is an aggressor or anybody is responding in a very provocative way, for example. But we can't do that because then we're going to miss the flow of history. We're going to realize that, wait a minute, if we just begin on point you know, B without looking at A, we're not going to understand why nations, why people, why leaders reacted in the way they did, right?
Well, that's true. I mean, to use a hockey analogy, which many of your Scandinavian listeners might appreciate, although I don't think they fight in Scandinavian hockey as much as they do in American and Canadian hockey.
Not yet, but they're starting to get there, by the way.
Well, in hockey, it's always the reactor who gets the penalty because the referee never sees the what the aggressor did with it, maybe hitting somebody in the face with a stick or something like that. And then when the player reacts, he's usually the one to be penalized.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, well, like you said, history is like a chain. And if you have a missing link in the chain, you no longer have a chain. You just have a jumble of facts. So it is absolutely critical to me to go back. I begin the Bad War in 1848. You could go back to the French Revolution, but at some point I wanted to, you know, have a limit. But that is where the story, almost a century before, believe it or not, that is where the story of World War II begins. And that's where my book begins, in 1848. 1848 was the year known as the Springtime of the Peoples. Does that sound familiar to you?
It sure does, yeah.
Spring.
Yep.
Well, that's where the Arab Spring takes its name from. The original European Spring was 1848. And what happened? Well, there were, quote, unquote, spontaneous revolts that broke out in 50 different states throughout Europe and also South America. And, you know, these were color revolutions. These were the early color revolutions. They were not spontaneous. They were planned years in advance. And it was the early effort of the Reds and their dupes to begin to weaken and destabilize what I call the old world order in order to bring about, quote unquote, democracy, which is nothing but a euphemism for bankers taking control through their political agents. So I talk a bit about 1848, which is the same year that Karl Marx published the Communist Manifesto. And, you know, it's important to understand that that was nothing but, I mentioned George Orwell's Animal Farm, how he exposes that. But what these empty promises of a utopian society and a workers' paradise did is they drew in a lot of well-meaning people who really believed crap.
Yep.
And contributed to the turmoil of 1848, which spread throughout the rest of the century. So this is how the murderous, genocidal communist movement began. And that's very important background to have if we're going to understand World War II, because that's what Hitler ultimately was fighting against, both internally and externally.
Yeah, that's a big thing that many people still don't understand, unfortunately, that there's so much more political going on here than, of course, an aggressor just showing up on the scene and doing all these things. But, you know, I think you make a good point. Springtime, as they call it, what has happened, to make a modern analogy, a lot of people in the conspiracy field, alternative world, if you will, the news, alternative news community, they can see that what has happened in the Arab world today is very much a front and a fraud. Maybe not everyone sees this, but a lot of people are getting their eyes open to this, that they realize what happened in Iraq and Libya, what is now happening in the Ukraine, Syria, and potentially in the future here, Iran. Who knows, maybe even Russia down the line here, too. That is something which has happened in our European countries much earlier than that. So when, you know, a lot of people look at Europe and say that, you know, Europe has been the aggressor, or that they are, you know, the people of Europe somehow are guilty for like a lot of these crimes and stuff like that, then people have to understand that, listen, European countries were one of the first to be hijacked by the New World Order and become the enforcer that brought, that is to bring the system to the rest of the world. That's how I view it anyway, Mike.
Well, yeah, that is where the cancer began. You know, the focal point being, or the nucleus, or the Typhoid Mary of this cancer being the Rothschild family and their web of operatives. But that's where it initiates, you know, Bavaria and places like that, and then it eventually spreads out its tentacles throughout the world. But, you know, the virus began in Europe, and people fail to realize it's, you know, kind of passed from our historical memory. It was a lot of turmoil and bloodshed and violence and subversion and evil going on throughout the 1800s, all of it serving to set the stage for the two big wars of the 20th century. So you cannot understand that unless you have at least a basic foundational understanding of the what went on in the 1800s. And that's the whole first section of my book, The Bad War.
Well, exactly. And, of course, we have, you know, Karl Marx coming onto the stage at that point. And, of course, you have – tell us a little bit more about what happened in Sicily and how this spread to different parts in Europe, Mike.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the parallels are, to this so-called Arab Spring, you know, it's uncanny. I mean, one can see the same hand behind it. But that is where the first revolutions, these revolts, broke out. And it began in Sicily. You know, and it just spread from country. I mean, back then, I mean, there were some large countries, of course, like France and England, but for the most part, Europe was smaller kingdoms and a whole lot of principalities. So it was actually 50 different states in which this broke out. But it began in January in Sicily. And I would point out that just 3 years earlier, Benjamin Disraeli, the Jewish prime minister of Great Britain, well, he was not the prime minister at the time. At the time, he was just a literary figure. But he wrote a book. It was a satirical book about the political scene at that time. It was called Coningsby, The Next Generation. And, you know, it was understood that he was talking about the Rothschilds and young England and these revolutionaries, etc. And he says right in the book, this is Rothschild talking. The character's name is Sidonia, but he represents Rothschild. He's talking about future revolts, which are already, the plans are already in place and will materialize in a few years. But he wrote that 3-4 years before the revolutions of 1848. And Disraeli was a well-connected insider. So that's, you know, it was sprung on an unsuspecting establishment at that time. It was very violent. And, you know, although they were eventually, these revolts were mostly put down, it served the purpose of weakening the existing structure and really injecting the cancer of liberalism and democracy into the political system, just weakening the existing governments. So, you know, superficially, it seems like the revolutions failed in 1848, but they didn't, because it was the first, you know, it was the first few cancer cells, you know, and it later metastasized years later. But it's important to understand 1848.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of people didn't do enough at the time, but that's what happens when you bring rhetoric to the table. Kind of, it's a early version of a kind of a mind control of really being subversive and saying something that appeals to people, but something that you don't really mean. You talk about social justice, you know, as you say it, or creating a workers' paradise, and a lot of people, you know, fell for that, unfortunately, and as a consequence, we've instead got a lot of, you know, a lot of violence, a system built on on envy, division among classes, you know, hostility towards free markets and tradition overall. So I think it's important to remember that it's a war really on human nature that began back then, although it didn't seem like that. But I think we can fully see it blooming out in our times today, you know?
Yeah, sometimes, Henrik, you really can't see things until they're far in the past, in the rearview mirror. It would have been very difficult at that time for some discerning people to see what was going on, because, I mean, if you read Marx superficially, you know, some of it sounds pretty good. I mean, he's talking about the abuses of the workers and the factories and, you know, things like that, but that's how the communists have always operated. They will key in on a legitimate grievance or injustice or what have you, and they will pound on that, and they'll keep pounding and pounding. Little do the unsuspecting suckers who jump on the bandwagon realize that it's only a ploy, because in the end, you're going to be far worse off under that Marxist system than you were under your previous masters, so-called. And that's the theme of the book, Animal Farm. You know, the animals stage a revolt. It's led by the pigs. And then when they overthrow the farmer, they realize the pigs were 100 times worse.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's it. That is Marxism in a nutshell.
Yeah, I mean, it was there as a way to actually prevent real changes from actually occurring at the time. I mean, I know that some systems were, you know, actually on a path towards reevaluating what was happening. Even certain systems under royalty that have been very feudal was actually undergoing already a kind of a change in transformation and adaptation to the times. And yes, partially that's due to some of the pressure that came along here from this force. So it's not, as you said, doesn't mean that it's all bad. It's not that black and white, but it means that someone got in there and they tried to piggyback other issues on this real, genuine sentiment of that things had to change. You know, but let's face it, if the Soviet Union was a workers' paradise, why did they kill people who tried to leave? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk a little bit more here about, as we kind of continue in the time. Actually, let me ask you about another thing. It's unrelated. It just came to me here. We did another show with a gentleman called Chris Fogarty, and let me ask you what you might or might not know about this, but it's actually about the Holocaust in Ireland. The real Holocaust there were estimated around 6 million people were starved to death, 6.5 or something like that, were starved to death due to British troops in Ireland at the time. So the different regiments and department in Ireland had actually a food removal regime in effect, where they removed basically all the food, and that consequently they blamed this on the potato famine and you know, another kind of issue of diversion, basically. But nonetheless, my question there has always been, I wonder what was happening in Britain at the time and who was controlling Britain to enforce this against their own you know, people. You mentioned Benjamin Disraeli. He was in power at that time, because this was in 1945 to 1950 that the Irish Holocaust, as it's called, actually occurred. And it would be interesting to know if these same forces that we're talking about here were actually in charge of Britain at the time, and that they were seeking to enforce something to begin to decimate an very old ancient culture of the Celts. Have you ever heard about this before, Mike?
Just only superficially. Well, Disraeli did not come to political power until 20 years after that, after he wrote that book. But I suspect, I mean, a lot of the British tyranny has to do with the just the British imperialist mindset on its own, apart altogether from the Rothschild forces. It just seems that this is the way the British have rolled historically with anyone who tries to oppose them. You know, when they hooked up with the Rothschilds, it just kind of had a synergistic effect, made things worse. But, I believe the British historically have been capable of some pretty dastardly deeds on their own without, you know, needing the Rothschilds to push them along in that direction.
Sure, yeah.
So,
yeah.
And that's part of the reason, too, for both world wars. I mean, the two factors, you needed both of them. You had to have that, the British imperialist mentality and the French imperialist mentality and envy towards Germany. That was a big part of it. But that in and of itself would not have brought about the wars without the globalist Rothschild influence, which itself could not have brought about the wars by itself. So you kind of needed both elements. And Hitler said it best in his final testament when he put the blame for the war on British commercial interests and international Jewry, both separate factors that kind of synergized together. So it's not all the Rothschilds, the British and the French. I mean, they could be real bastards on their own.
Yeah, exactly. Well, of course, it's always about that elite people that, you know, either have their own individual desires or if there's something, you know, greater than that. But again, usually it's today, consequences of colonialism or imperialism is, of course, blamed on the people itself, which is a very unfortunate and an unfair thing to do when you realize that they're, as an establishment in charge, that actually are taking care of business at the top, you know?
Yeah, it's always the case.
So tell us about Reuters Telegram Company.
Okay, well, that is one of the entries in my timeline. And my timeline is like probably, I want to say like at least 200 events that have a caption, a couple paragraphs, and some pictures. But that was 1865, and I felt that was very important to mention because we all know who controls the press. But this was really the first major acquisition in 1865. Paul Reuter established the Reuters News Agency. His birth name was Israel Berra Jehoshaphat. And, I mean, it was an empire, and it was really the first big news agency. And it was under Jewish control, and it marks that point in history where the Jews and the Zionists really began to control the press. So, but Reuters is huge because they would feed their stories all over the world, and then even newspapers that were not Zionist-owned would still pick up on the stories,
right,
and the twist and the biases and run with them. So again, it has that virus effect. So that's a very major point in history, 1865, Reuters.
Yeah, exactly. Very good. Let's talk about the next point there as well, actually, because that's, I guess, when real kind of conflict is actually setting in, Franco-Prussian wars. And we've had for a long time, of course, you know, Germany occupied France, France occupied Germany. You know, this has gone back and forth. I mean, it's got to be one of those borders in the history of Europe that has been tremendously intense. I went to Strasbourg in France a few years ago, and this one, I would say, of few places is where you can go and you don't really know if you're in France or in Germany. It's truly a blend between the two, but that's not what you get generally. Once you travel across that border, you get a completely different feel, different people, different food, different architecture. I mean, it's people are completely different. It's quite extraordinary. But anyway, point being, they've warred for a long time back and forth, and that kind of sets the stage a bit, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it does. And at this time, 1870, you know, Prussia is a kingdom, a large kingdom, but there is no united Germany. There's 30 other smaller states. And essentially the Franco-Prussian War, you know, that was a project of Napoleon III, Emperor Napoleon III, who was a nephew of the original Napoleon. But that was an imperialistic drive by France. And it's interesting, even establishment historians today will put the blame for this war on France, not on Germany. But again, this is a key precedent because here you have France initiating and losing a war with Germany or Prussia. And it was out of this war that Prussia and the other smaller German states united and the German Reich was formed. But France, you know, they always had it in their mind to get another crack at Germany after this war. And, you know, as we know, that's what happened in the following century. But very important to understand, France started and lost the Franco-Prussian War.
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's continue here in the timeline and talk about some of the things that really stand out here. Of course, we have, as you said, the formation, really, of one of the first Reichs at this time as well. that is starting to occur. Was any of the early German unification attempts and all that, do you think that any of those were elite-driven, co-opted by the elite, or were these genuine sentiments and real movements, Mike?
Well, the unification, was voluntary. I mean, all the German states combined and fought together. So it's not as if Kaiser Wilhelm and Chancellor Bismarck of Prussia, had to conquer anybody against their will. I mean, certainly the war with Prussia gave impetus to the German states uniting and realizing the benefits of mutual defense. But out of the unification, it was another benefit. I mean, Germany now as a united state really began to grow and outproduce and outcompete France and Britain. I mean, they made their goods better and cheaper than anyone. And certainly this triggered envy amongst other powers. But Germany took off. I mean, between 1870 and World War One, what they accomplished was, quite remarkable. But the German Reich was peaceful. But nonetheless, they attracted a certain amount of envy towards themselves for being so successful.
Yeah, that's always been the case, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Just a side note on that, how were the Jews treated during this time?
Well, it's interesting because when the German Reich was formed, in that very first year, it was Chancellor Bismarck. Well, he was the chancellor. I mean, Germany had a Kaiser, but the political leader was Bismarck. Germany became the first major European country to grant full citizenship rights to the Jews. They were treated very well. The Germans were very tolerant. The concept of anti-Semitism existed kind of on the margins. And again, this is very critical to understand because by the time we get to, the rise of Hitler and his movement in the 1920s, I mean, that's 50 years later. So you have 50 years of history of the Jews thriving, prospering, and being happy and well treated in Germany. So a logical mind has got to ask themselves, wait a minute, what could cause this nation to turn? They were so good to the Jews. So that's why that's one of my entries in the book. I make a point to illustrate that it was Germany that granted full citizenship rights to the Jews before any other country did.
Well, that's quite remarkable. So what happened there? Because, of course, previously we've had Jewish emancipation, as it was called, and it was, of course, occurring at different times in different European countries, and it was more or less believed that this, of course, is an outcome due to many of the revolutions that were occurring, specifically starting in France, as you mentioned before there. But how come they ended up feeling so let down by the Germans? What's the relationship here?
Why the Jews felt let down?
Yeah.
Well, that was 50 years later. We have to fast forward to World War One. There came a point in World War One where Germany was winning that war, and they were on the brink of victory. And unbeknownst to them at the time, the Zionists had made a dirty deal with the British. They basically approached Britain and said, listen, you don't have to make an armistice with Germany. We can get America in the war on your side. You just have to allow it to take control of Palestine from the Ottoman Turks, who are allied with Germany, and allow us to immigrate there. So when it became to the Jewish benefit for Germany to lose World War One, all of a sudden the Jewish press, which dominated Germany, they turned against the war effort. The Jewish union leaders organized strikes in the factories just when the German troops needed the munitions the most. So Germany was stabbed in the back. And this is what modern historians refer to as the legend of the stab in the back. But there was nothing legendary about it. It was very real. And there were two elements of Jewry at work here. One was the Zionists, who wanted Britain to win so they can get Israel. And then the other was the Jewish Marxists, who basically wanted to subvert and overthrow Germany. And when this became understood after World War I, that's when many Germans began turning against the Jews. And it was the end of that cozy, warm, cordial, friendly relationship, 50-year relationship that had existed. So we never hear about that in the history books.
No, we don't. We don't.
That for 50 years, there was no problem in Germany. And the Jews prospered like no other.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. Yeah, very important to remember this as well. And, of course, we jumped forward a little bit in the timeline. That's fine, too. We don't have to go through every point here. But just a quick mention here, there was, of course, also several assassination attempts made on various German leaders at the time. And I believe that some of those assassinators were Jewish as well, correct?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I mean, here you have the Chancellor Bismarck and the Kaiser Wilhelm, you know, granting full citizenship privileges to the Jews. And yet in 1874, Bismarck survives an assassination attempt by a Jew named Edward Coleman. And earlier there had been another one by Frederick Cohen. So you had two assassination attempts against Bismarck, both by Jews. So that's the gratitude he gets for being so good to them.
Oh boy.
So, I mean, which goes to show you that when the Marxists talk about, you know, anti-Semitism, they really don't. It's just a ploy. I mean, they wanted power. They wanted to overthrow Germany. It doesn't matter what Bismarck or the Kaiser did.
So, in other words, the reaction here is, from a political point of view, very understandable, specifically at a time when the various nations are not so kind of blended together, for the lack of a better term, as they are today, when people are, you know, they travel freely and, you know, a lot of people are just kind of, we have a lot of immigration into the European countries and this kind of ethnic homogenous feeling, the sense of a folk, the sense of a belonging together with your people were probably more prominent at those times, meaning that it would be more in the open, more clear that if you had a group internally in the country that were kind of turning against the leadership of the country, then obviously they would have a reaction to that and say, we have to defend ourselves against this, correct?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you know, that they did. But yet, you know, neither Bismarck nor the Kaiser ever took an openly anti-Semitic position or anti-Semitic rhetoric. Whatever they did to suppress these movements, you know, it was targeted at the Marxists. But, you know, they never really, you know, openly went after the Jews in that sense. So it's almost as if it's like they made a distinction. You know, we're going to go after the communists and we're going to try to shut them down, but we're not going to have like a wholesale anti-Semitic purge. So in spite of all that was happening, in spite of the overwhelming Jewish leadership of the communist movements, Germany kept their attempts to suppress it. I mean, they kept the whole Jewish angle out of it. I mean, you won't find any kind of rhetoric coming out of the German leadership at that time about the Jews this or the Jews that. I mean, I'm sure they knew privately, but for probably not wanting to incite the entire Jewish community, they just went after, you know, they kept their rhetoric to, you know, going after the communists.
Right. Now, let us work ourselves up in the timeline here a little bit. I want to, of course, talk. We can talk a little bit about what triggered the First World War, but you have another interesting passage where you basically talk about Bismarck's kind of final warning and prediction, accurately in this case, about how it was something that started in the Balkans.
Well, yeah, that's right, because from the very beginning, I mean, I guess we should briefly mention the League of the Three Emperors,
yeah,
which Bismarck, you know, put together. It was a defensive alliance between the German Reich, the Russian Empire, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And this was purely defensive. Its purpose was to block British and French intrigue in that part of the world, and also to suppress the internal communist movements at that time. And the three were mutually pledged not to ever go to war against each other, always to, you know, seek dialogue and resolve differences through diplomacy. So you had now all of Central and Eastern Europe is in one defensive block. These were large empires. And I point out in the book that there can be no new world order until this mighty defensive coalition of empires is somehow broken up and individually smashed. So, and that's precisely what Benjamin Disraeli would later engineer. He created a wedge between Austria-Hungary and Russia. And ultimately, that led to World War I. Because World War I, you recall, after Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, Russia was compelled to war against Austria-Hungary, and then Germany was compelled to defend Austria-Hungary, and that's how it all got started. But you have to go back to the 1800s, because these three great empires were once very closely linked until Disraeli stuck his nose in there and separated the three great allies.
Yeah, so many good gems here historically in the book. So just let me know if I'm leaving something important out that you feel so we should yeah. touch upon here for sure. But you talk about the early formation of NATO, basically a coalition here between the French and the British. Very important. It kind of sets the groundwork for a lot of the madness that we see happening today. You know.
Well, yeah. I mean, to me, when France and Britain teamed up and made an alliance, that was the forerunner of modern day NATO. You know, it's just the United States was kind of thrown into that mix after World War I.
Yeah.
But I wanted to move ahead a little bit and talk about. Well, let's get back to what you mentioned. Yes, Bismarck, basically on his deathbed, predicted that in 20 years there would be a great war and a collapse, because he saw already what the kind of manipulation that was taking place, engineered by the British mainly, in Southeast Europe.
Yeah.
What else was happening at this time? Well, France now remember, we spoke about France losing the Franco-Prussian War, and they wanted another crack at Germany. And to that end, they allied themselves with the Russian Empire. This was after the Three Emperors League had disbanded. And my book goes into the reasons why and how Disraeli engineered that. But when France reached out and made this alliance with Russia, they were already thinking ahead towards the great war that they had planned against Germany, which would later be World War I. So again, this is critical, because we're establishing the precedent, building on the precedent that was set at the Franco-Prussian War, now leading to World War I. It is always the West, the French and the British, who are projecting the aggression eastward. Okay?
Yeah.
And that's why I talk about this. I want to establish clearly that Germany was not only innocent World War II, cannot be blamed for World War II, but World War I as well.
Yeah.
And I have a great quote that I dug up in here from the legendary Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy, who wrote War and Peace. He described the Franco-Russian alliance as a trick to get Russia into fighting France's enemy, which would be Germany. And he makes a sarcastic comment here about the French. He says, these people suddenly, without reason, suddenly profess such spontaneous and exceptional love for Russia. Because now, at this time, France was a republic again, a democratic republic and all that, and Russia was authoritarian. And Tolstoy's making the point, why do they love us so much all of a sudden? And then he goes on to say, the Franco-Russian alliance cannot now present itself as anything else than what it is, a league of war. And he said this in 1894. This is 20 years before World War I. He already knew what was going down that they were, France was angling to attack Germany and draw Russia in as an ally. And then a few years later, Great Britain joined this this alliance, and that was the Triple Entente: Britain, France, Russia. Okay,
yeah.
And it was all aimed at Germany. Now, Russia was not really a hostile toward Germany. The reason they entered the alliance is they wanted another crack at Turkey. You know, they wanted to reclaim territory from Turkey. So, you know, everybody was in it for something. You know, the French wanted territory. The British wanted to suppress the Germans. The Russians were looking for territory in Turkey. And also they wanted to support their Serbian ally. The only innocent party, when you fast forward to World War One, was Germany. I mean, they were just, it was Germany, it was Kaiser Wilhelm II at the 11th hour who was trying to get Austria-Hungary to have dialogue with Serbia and not go to war. He was reaching out to Russia. He was reaching out to France. It is clear that World War One was just like World War Two, where you had Germany all the way up until the 11th hour pleading for reason and calm and peace. And yet, Germany is blamed for both world wars today in modern history. And it's all a big lie.
Oh, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing, you know, that people don't see through it and they don't realize that, as you said, the precedence, the hatred as well expressed towards Germany, the jealousy, the envy, the due to their industriousness and all the stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, it really boggles the mind. I mean, it is a complete reality, you know, an inversion of reality. So
yeah,
I make that very clear in the opening chapters of The Bad War. Germany was the victim of the Franco-Prussian War. Germany was the victim of World War One. And I quote Bismarck and Tolstoy. It's very clear. And then when you realize that this country, which did everything it could to avoid the war, both before and even during the war, it was always Germany trying to stop it. And here they have the Treaty of Versailles imposed upon them, which imposed the war guilt clause upon them, forced Germany to accept responsibility for the war. I mean, Heinrich, this is analogous to somebody being jumped in a dark alley in the middle of the night by three or four thugs, fighting back tenaciously and giving a bloody good beating to the thugs before finally succumbing to them, and then being forced to accept the blame. And that is exactly what happened. I am not exaggerating in the slightest.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right, exactly. It's unbelievable. Now, how do you put, we could just spend a little bit on this here, maybe, just what kind of lights the fuse of the Balkans, as it's been called here, from 1914 and onwards. We have, of course, Gavrilo Princip, right? He comes from this, I don't know how much emphasis you put on this in terms of if there's anything else more behind this. He was behind, was it the Black Hand, as a kind of secret society, right? And he ends up, of course, shooting Archduke Franz Ferdinand, that really kind of triggers the whole thing. So how did you piece this together of how this kind of blooms out from the Balkans?
Well, I mean, the meal had already been prepared. It's just a matter of turning on the heat. And that was the what the assassination accomplished. But going back to the Russo-Turkish War and what Benjamin Disraeli did, you remember I spoke earlier about how he busted up the League of the Three Emperors?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Russia had essentially won the war with Turkey, and then Britain interjected itself, and there was a peace conference in Berlin, and basically Disraeli is making all these threats towards Russia to make all these concessions towards Turkey. So that created a problem. But some of the Slavic people who had fought with Russia in order to liberate themselves from Turkey, they were transferred from Turkish sovereignty to Austria-Hungarian sovereignty. And in particular, this was a big problem for the Serbians of Bosnia. They were reassigned to the Austro-Hungarian Empire instead of being attached to Serbia. And this is what caused the divorce between Russia and Austria-Hungary and broke up the league. And it also gave the globalists now a weak spot. They can create this movement of Serbian nationalism in Bosnia, who would claim that, you know, they're oppressed by Austria-Hungary and they want to be part of Serbia and so on. And that's how these secret societies formed. And this assassination now was designed to get Austria-Hungary to wage war against Serbia, because that would compel Russia to come to Serbia's defense, who was their ally, and that would trigger the whole shebang, because then Germany would have to defend Austria-Hungary, and then France, they all felt like dominoes. The assassination was key. It was intended to get Austria-Hungary to attack Serbia. So, what happened? The Archduke and his wife are traveling in their carriage, their motorcade. It wasn't a carriage, it was a car. But anyway, prior to being shot, there were two bombs were thrown at the Archduke. One missed. A few blocks later, there was another one. He swiped it away with his arm, and it exploded near the crowd. And then later on, then he went to the hospital to see some of the people who were hurt. And then leaving the hospital, he was shot by this lone gunman. So, and this is left out of the history books. There were three attempts in one afternoon.
Wow.
So this was clearly a conspiracy. They were out to get him. And when he was assassinated, the Jewish-owned press of Vienna began fomenting, agitating. And there was so much pressure put on Austria-Hungary to make war against Serbia. And now as this is going on, the Kaiser and the Tsar, who are cousins, by the way, were in communication. They were called the Nicky Wicky cables, Nicky for Nicholas and Willy for Wilhelm. And you read these cables, and it is clear that both of them wanted to avoid this this mess. But yet, at the same time, they were kind of trapped. There were forces at work. I mean, all these alliances were trapped. There were people within probably intriguers within each of their governments working towards war. So at the same time that the two, the Kaiser and the Tsar, were trying to avoid war, they were being drawn into it. And the Tsar actually thanks Kaiser Wilhelm for intervening and trying to mediate peace and dialogue between Austria-Hungary and Serbia. He's actually thanking the Germans for avoiding a war.
Wow.
But then eventually Austria-Hungary succumbs, and the pressure builds for war against Serbia. Russia starts to mobilize, and that triggers France. And at that point, when it became clear that war was coming, you know, Germany had to attack in both directions. But it was the Russians, albeit reluctantly, and the French, enthusiastically, who mobilized first. Germany was the last country to mobilize. And they struck out in both directions, and they were successful in the first year of the war. And that's how World War I started. But that was the point of the assassination, to just get this, all of these dominoes that had been lined up in the decades previous. We had to push the first one, and that was the point of the pre-planned assassination.
Wow, yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. And of course, the relations there between Germany and Russia is pretty interesting, too. You have, as you said, cousins in positions of power here, and it's even before the First World War is over, the Russian Revolution occurs in 1917, which is, of course, designed to remove the Tsar and to break up, I think, a lot of those kinds of, well, there are a lot of reasons for it, but to break up that some of those bonds and relationships, I think, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that was part of the bigger picture all along. You know, the ultimate globalist Zionists, they envisioned many things for World War I. One was the opportunity to steal Palestine from the Ottoman Empire, but also to overthrow the hated Tsar, and then later on the Kaiser. So it was mutually destructive for many parties. But in the end, the great empires, the Russian, the German, the Austro-Hungarian, and even the Turkish, were all busted up and dismantled. And that was all part of the higher purpose of World War One. As far as inducing the Russians to fight with the British and the French, they were played for fools. Tolstoy was right. And ironically, or predictably, given the history of how the West operates, after the Tsar was overthrown, while he was still alive and in the custody of the Democratic Socialist government, which in turn would later be overthrown by the Bolsheviks, but he was seeking exile. And here you have these so-called allies of the Triple Entente. They wouldn't let him in because of the Jewish pressure. There was no way to Britain or France to take in the Tsar. The Rothschilds wouldn't have it. So that's why for months, even after he was forced to abdicate, he was still in Russia and nobody would take him. And while, you know, the democratic regime of Kerensky was in power, he, the Tsar and his family, at least were safe. They were under house arrest, but they were treated well until, you know, I mean, sooner or later they would have been exiled. But then when the Bolshevik Revolution came, the Tsar, his wife, his five children, and his servants were marked for a horrific, brutal death and mass murder. It's just horrific what they did to them. But always remember, it was the so-called allies of England and France that left their ally twisting in the wind when they could have granted him exile.
Yeah, it's extraordinary for sure. And then, of course, post this, you do have the two very, very important things that do occur. You have the Treaty of Versailles coupled with, and this is prior, before I think it actually ended too, but the Lord Balfour, of course, writes to Lord Rothschild to set up the Zionist state, that famous letter. We can link to it too. But he says, "Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionists' aspiration, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet." It goes on to say, "His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine." Yeah, right. Or,
yeah, right. That's exactly what I was thinking.
Or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Anyway, it's signed to Lord Rothschild. So, yeah, there you have it.
Yeah, there you have it. What an interesting time to release such a statement. Why? What was the motivation? Because the dirty deal had been made. You promise us Palestine, we'll get America into the war. And all of a sudden, somebody flicked the switch, and in America, the Kaiser and the Germans became, you know, vicious, bloodthirsty Huns. I mean, there was no reason at all for the United States to get into this war. And it's interesting, even many people today who study history and even establishment historians look back at World War One and say, yeah, it was kind of weird why we got in there. There was no reason for it.
Yeah.
But there's a reason for everything. And there it is. Actually, the reason was twofold. One is globalism, one is Zionism, and both of them overlap greatly, as you know.
Yeah. Wow, extraordinary. Now, let's wrap up the timeline here for the first, leading up to the First World War, consequently after what happens here, and then, of course, in the next segment, we can get deeper into the Second World War as we continue the timeline here. But is there anything else that stands out that we should get out before we talk a little bit more about where people can pick up a copy of the book, Mike?
Well, yes, the absolute brutality of the Treaty of Versailles, and as well as economic reparations, which would devastate the German economy, lead to hyperinflation. Most of your listeners probably already know that, but again, just imagine, here you have Germany, which before the war, during the war, pleaded for peace again and again and again, bears 0% responsibility for the war, and they have to endure this monstrous treaty, which not only punished them economically, but created two flashpoints for a future war against Germany if it was deemed necessary. And they took a chunk of land. They took all of Western Prussia and they gave it to Poland. And then they left Eastern Prussia, part of Germany, yet isolated from the rest of the mainland, like some island. And the Germans would be very severely mistreated there. And it was from there that Poland could abuse the Germans who were stranded in East Prussia. And I have a map in there of my book, so you can see this abortion that was committed on a map that could only cause future tension between Germany and Poland. And then the second flashpoint is the Sudetenland, which was assigned to Czechoslovakia. 3 million Germans, 99% of the population was German. There's just no reason, conceivable reason, to give this little jagged strip of what should have been the southern frontier of Germany. They assigned it to the hostile puppet state of Czechoslovakia. And those Germans in time would be mistreated, and that was a flashpoint, which Hitler was able to defuse in 38. But was not able to defuse the problem in Poland in 39. So they were already thinking ahead, and they do this all the time, Henrik. You go back to, you know, the Congress of Berlin or the Versailles Treaty, or even the North Korea, South Korea setup. These globalists are always planning for the next war in case they need it. And the best way to trigger that is to create these abortions on a map. And that's what they did with the Treaty of Versailles and also the Treaty of Saint-Germain. So it's essential to understand that, because then you'll understand, you know, 1938 and the Munich and Czechoslovakia controversy, and of course 1939 when the war actually began. So
yeah,
a very important precedent about the absolute abuse and oppression and hostility towards and aggression towards totally innocent Germany.
You know, I wonder if they, the elite, the globalists here, knew that people will ever be in a position like we are today to be able to piece together the story in this capacity. The globalists, of course, have taken advantage of these situations that occurred at that time to peddle their own agendas and get control of larger areas, etc. But obviously the crime today is that they still continue to deny it. We're in a position now where we can expose their game, and it's really criminal of people who continue to put blame on Germany as the aggressor, or that they, even that the actions of the National Socialists is somehow coming out of the blue like a madman that's trying to go after the world and conquer the conquer the entire globe. It's insanity, you know.
Yeah, it really is. It is just a total inversion of reality. One quick point to make about Versailles. Oh, by the way, Germany was not permitted to participate in this treaty, which they were tricked into. And that's critical. Woodrow Wilson basically said to the Germans, well, listen, the tide is turning against you. Tell you what, lay down your arms and we will have a, quote, peace without victory. Okay? And partially because there were deluded Germans who believed this lie, and partially because there was treason within Germany, that's what they actually did. It's incredible. They laid down their arms with not one square inch of German territory under occupation, and they basically went home. I mean, they put their own neck in the noose, and at that point, the so-called peace without victory became a peace at gunpoint. It was a blockade was placed on Germany. 100,000 Germans died as a result of the hunger blockade. The purpose of the blockade was to sign the Treaty of Versailles. Sign this treaty or we will kill you. So in addition to the treaty being horrific and brutal, they were tricked into surrendering, number one, and two, they had to force to sign the treaty at gunpoint. Okay, that's known as duress. You don't need to be a lawyer to understand that any contract under duress is null and void.
Yeah.
And any contract induced by fraud, the fraud of peace without victory, is null and void. This was just a shameful episode in history that, even many modern-day liberal establishment historians will concede how horrible this was.
Very good, Mike. Fantastic stuff here, of course. We'll pick this up and talk more about this here in the second hour as we continue. But let's talk a little bit more about the book here, of course. It's called The Bad War, The Truth Never Taught about World War II, and it's absolutely essential for people who want to understand what happens at the time, the lead up to it, the chain events, the agendas behind it and why it turns out in the way it does. And again, you know, just to emphasize that, you pull out some excellent, you know, points and just really kind of condense down the history in that capacity. And it's a very good overview to get that big picture of how things are, you know, going on. But tell us more about your website, Mike, of course, for people who might be new to it, and tell us how we can get a copy of the book.
Okay, you can go to tomatobubble.com. There, you know, lots of information there prominently featured. Probably about 80 to 90% of the content of the site is free. But if somebody wants to order the book either in PDF format or in paperback via Amazon, you know, they can do so easily at the site. They'll see it. Just look for the, you know, the artistic image of the Bad War. And that is, you know, I want to say the artist, I don't know if you've heard of him, David Dees.
Oh, sure. He lived in Sweden for a while. I don't know if he still is there.
Yeah. Well, he did the cover art. And to me, that cover is as important as the interior. I think it was stunning what he did.
He's a great artist, yeah.
Yeah, people have to go to his site, or, I don't know, maybe you could post it as well.
Sure, I will.
On the front, you have the big three, and then you've got Hitler and German people and bombers. And on the back, there's a heartbreaking image of Dresden. But yeah, go to tomatobubble.com, and people can, you know, they can actually read a free excerpt at the site, as well as at Amazon.com, where the paperback is available.
Very good. Thank you, Mike. Tomatobubble.com, and also check out deesillustration.com. That's the artist that did the great front cover to the book. But yeah, we'll take a short break here. Ladies and gentlemen, stay with us. We'll be right back with more. Please stay with us if you want to hear more as we continue the chronology lead up to World War II, and also as we go post World War II, to talk about what happened and the unrecognized war crimes that occurred afterwards. Very important and fascinating history from Mike King. So please join us at redicemembers.com to hear more. We do spare you from commercial interruptions and blinking website banners. So if you want to hear more, you can sign up for a membership and get full access to our archives. We have so many interesting researchers, authors, and writers featured in the archive as a method to expose the global game of geopolitics and dynamics of conflict creation in order to control the narrative and give the globalists the desired outcome. We have upcoming on the show, by the way, Ole Damegård on the events in Paris and Copenhagen. We talk with Nick Kellerstrom on his book Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality. We also have Sally Fallon, Gilad Atzmon, E. Michael Jones, and many more coming on after that. But we'll pick this up right after the break. Stay with us, folks. Thank you so much for listening.